Haunted Nights, live with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross.
Like to thank W.J. Pierce for creating and performing our music. Good evening and welcome to Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live. This is your host, Alistair Cross. I'm usually here with my co-host and collaborator, Tamara Thorne, but something came up and she wasn't able to make it, so I'm flying solo today. Very quickly, you can learn more about what we do at our websites, alistaircross.com and tamarathorne.com, or you can visit our mutual blog at thornandcross.wordpress.com, or if you tweet, our handles are at Cross Alistair and at Tamara Thorne. You can also visit us on Facebook on our Haunted Nights Live page. For more information on the show, you can visit Authors on the Air on Facebook, Twitter, and at AuthorsOnTheAir.com. This is a broadcast of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. Tonight, we're doing something a little bit different. We're very excited. We're talking to writer, broadcaster, and word lover Charles Harrington Elster, whose books include Tooth and Nail and The Test of Time, which are vocabulary-building novels for high school students preparing to take college entrance exams. He's also the author of There's a Word for It, What in the Word, The Accidents of Style, Good Advice on How Not to Write Badly, and the big book of beastly mispronunciations. Mispronunciations. See what I did there? Charlie has been talking about language on the radio since 1985. He's been interviewed on NPR's Talk of the Nation, Weekend Edition, and All Things Considered. And he's been a guest on hundreds of radio shows around the country. We are thrilled to have you, Charlie. Welcome aboard. How are you?
Thanks, Alistair, for having me on. I'm doing great.
Nice. I guess the first thing that I'd like to know is, again, I want to say Tamara isn't able to be here tonight. She was really, really excited. She's very bummed. She gives her best. We hope that you'll come back. She was really looking forward to meeting you. So I am not familiar with your work. She had found you and she was very impressed, and I have some of your stuff, some of your books coming my way, so I'm excited to dig into them. But I guess first things first, first of all, tell us what you do exactly.
Well, I wander around and make sure that, first of all, that people aren't mispronouncing mispronunciations. And which you did not do.
I thought I did. good.
Because, you know, one of the worst offenses against the English language is people who complain about other people who mispronunciate their words. and who have terrible pronunciation. I hate that, okay? So I'm out there with a double-barreled shotgun aiming at all those people. And I hope they don't get up and start walking around like zombies, you know, and mispronunciating their words. So I mean, my magnum opus is the big book of beastly mispronunciations, and I'm hoping to get it into a third edition sometime soon. As you can tell, I'm a bit snarky about my opinions about language. I don't kill anybody, though. I'm more of a physician. I do no harm, but definitely state my opinion. So, you know, you're free.
Right.
You're free to say what you want to do, and it's all up to you because we all make the language. But by God, you're gonna hear me out, okay? That's
right.
Where I'm coming from.
All right. It's funny because I knew when I was doing the bio, you know, writing it up and trying to condense it, because you've got a lot. You've really achieved a lot. You've got a lot under your belt. So I'm like, oh great, watch. I'm going to be tripping all up just because of what you do. So be prepared for more of that. It's going to happen. It just is. But I guess I'm curious about how you got interested in this. I know that for some of us, I think writers, I think there's people who are just kind of attracted to language. I know I was one of those people. I don't really know why, but it made sense to me. I learned it quickly. I didn't have any problems with language. Now, math, on the other hand, I was horrible at, but language always made sense to me, And so it kind of wasn't a surprise that I went into writing. But what you do is, I mean, you're a writer, yes, but you take it a step further. I mean, you really get into this. You've got a lot out there. And I'm wondering, what made you originally interested in what you do in language?
Well, it was really my parents. My parents, interestingly, were both professional musicians. My father was a world-class harpist, the principal harpist for the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra in New York City, was his career for 38 years. But even before that, he got that job. He did all kinds of wonderful freelancing for big bands and Toscanini, NBC Symphony Orchestra, and if you listen to the classic Mel Torme song, Christmas song sung by Nat King Cole, that's my dad on the harp. So, you know, my mother went to Oberlin Conservatory and was a music educator, but they both loved language. And my mother also especially was a word person, and she would always send me to the big unabridged dictionary and you know, on the table in the living room when there was an argument about words, and we would hunch over it panting, you know, and then just like, who's going to win this argument, you know? And she would read to me. Reading in families is so important, reading to your children. And my father was very into words. As a musician, he went to Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, and he didn't have time with all the practicing and studying music and so forth to get the normal college education, the literary background or whatever, liberal arts, you know. So he was a self-taught person. He was an autodidact in that regard, because he did love language and he did love poetry, and he shared a lot of things that he loved with me as well. So, you know, I like to say that I had two parents who made music for a living and loved words, who raised a son who loves music. I'm sort of an amateur musician, having gone through many, many instruments and failed.
Oh, nice.
But, you know, they raised a son who loves music but tries to make his living with words. So, you know, it all comes around.
Nice. That's interesting. Did you you've been doing this for a long time. I'm curious, are there any words out there that are correct and proper that make really no sense to you at all, that you really, it just bugs you that they're there?
Well, I think you're foreshadowing what we're going to get into in a moment. I think in my top 10 list of horrifying mistakes made by ambulatory semi-literate zombies. because you know, if you want me to get into that, I can get into that, because that is a very long list, but I've restricted it to 10.
All right, let's do the top 10 list. I'm looking forward to it, and then let's talk about your latest book. But first, your top 10 list. Let's do it.
Okay, here we go, and we'll do this David Letterman style. So we'll start at 10 and we'll go to 1. Okay.
All right.
and I want your listeners to note that even though I am what's called a prescriptivist about language, or a normative grammarian, or a language snob, if you don't like that kind of person, you know, who has an opinion about words, for crying out loud, if you don't have an opinion about words, you might as well just shut your mouth and go
right,
to sleep and die,
right.
You know. Everybody should have an opinion about words. And if yours is different from mine, well, let's argue about it. But, you know, don't tell me that I can't have an opinion, for crying out loud. So, you know, I should do Lewis Black. Don't tell me I can't, you know. And so, you know, I will not in this list tell you that you can't use a splint. You can't split an infinitive. I will not tell you can't use a preposition at the end of a sentence. And I will not tell you that you can't use a conjunction at the beginning of a sentence, because all those things are misconceptions that a lot of people have about people like me who have an opinion about language. Those things, prepositions at the end, not where is it at, because that's just redundant, okay, or pleonastic,
right.
But as Shakespeare wrote, you know, what am I thinking here? Music to, oh shoot, this example just eluded me, but as Theodore Bernstein said, he wrote The Careful Writer. He was the managing editor of the New York Times Magazine for many, many years. And he says, people who think that you can't put a preposition at the end of a sentence don't have a leg on which to stand. So, you know, this is something that reputable writers in English have been using for a long time. And okay. Conjunctions, read your Bible. The Bible starts with
right.
And, you know,
right.
Two-thirds of the sentences in the Bible starts with and, you know. And split infinitives, totally natural, used by tons of reputable writers for centuries. So you will not hear me complaining about that. So back to the list of top 10. Here's number 10. Overuse of the word impact. And this is the only time I ever utter the word impact that I have ever uttered it in the last 35 years. You know, why do we need to use a pile driver when a putty knife will do? That's my line. Impact
right, right.
is a pile driver for the regular words effect and influence. What's wrong with those
right.
words? You know, this impacts
yeah.
that. This is so, you know, and now we have impactful presentations and,
right.
and the impactfulness and all this stuff. It's just disgusting. Okay, and number 9. Verbal versus oral, okay? All these semi-literate zombies think that verbal means oral. They say it's a verbal contract or a verbal agreement. Well, sorry, but verbal means expressed in words, whether written or spoken, not expressed in spoken words. Oral means expressed in spoken words and speech. So verbal could go both ways, but people have
right.
confused that. Okay, number 8. This is a somewhat subtle one that I've been monitoring for a while. There are a lot of zombies out there who are just wandering around saying who for things instead
right.
of
right.
reserving you who for people. Okay, they're saying corporations who, institutions who, hospitals who, schools who, et cetera, et cetera. So have you heard this?
Yeah, no, totally. And the vice and vice versa as well. You know, the person that, you know.
Well, I'm getting to that. See, that's
yeah,
another
yeah, I hear
one
that
of those. It's one of those
misconceptions,
again, like the prepositions at the end or the split infinitive. To use that for a person is not a mistake. It is not a mistake. It has been done for centuries. That has been used for people longer than who has been used for people. These are called relative pronouns.
Yeah.
And you've got who, that, and which. And which was once used for people, if you remember your Lord's Prayer in the King James Version of the Bible, 1611, it says, "Our Father, which art in heaven." You recall that?
Yeah, I do.
So
I do,
that,
now that you say it, yeah.
Yeah, so that, I mean, that's the way I learned it. But which fell out of favor for people, and who became the preferred relative pronoun for people. But that has never been supplanted as an acceptable pronoun for people, except that in the last century or so, a lot of people mistakenly have complained about it being used for people, and that's just wrong. Mark Twain in 1899 wrote a story called The Man That The man that something Hadleyburg, the man that invaded Hadleyburg,
right,
or something
right.
like that. Corrupted Hadleyburg, that's what it was. And so, you know, it's really just a matter of your ear. That is okay for people. Who is unimpeachable for people. But who for things, not good. You should not say
yeah.
a radio show who. You know, you should not say
right.
the Census Bureau who. You should not. And I've seen these things in the New Yorker and the New York Times and so on and so forth. And it's just terrible. I've heard it from, you know, from Robert Siegel on NPR. Hospitals who.
Right.
What the heck? Hospitals
yeah.
who? You know, as one of my colleagues once said, Patricia O'Connor, she's a wonderful language maven, and she once said, if it doesn't have a face, it's not a who.
Ooh, good one. That's good. Nice, easy
okay.
to remember. That's a good one.
Yeah. It's a good mnemonic.
Doesn't
yeah.
have a face,
so
not a who.
Let's keep going.
All right.
I got a couple of I've got a couple of pronunciation guys on my top 10, and number 7 is homage, H-O-M-A-G-E, which is increasingly mispronounced homage without the H, or worse, homage. What's with the de-anglicization? What did somebody tell you to start speaking French in front of in the
I
middle
know.
Of a perfectly decent English sentence? You know what's going on here? You know? This
so,
is
so
a word
on
that
note. On that note, what is your opinion on vase for vase or envelope for envelope? Does that any opinion on that?
Well, in my big book of beastly mispronunciations, I do opine about those words. I do not like Frenchified pronunciations. I do not like them, especially if they are re-Frenchified, okay? So envelope is my preferred. And what was your other one?
Vase.
Oh, well, that's just pretentious. You know, that you've got three
right.
possibilities there. You've got vase, vase, and vase. And vase is the most pretentious one. So,
I agree.
Yeah. But, you know, I kind of grew up with that with my mom. She was a New Englander. She was sort of a vase-y person. So she also liked
yeah.
the Frenchified stuff. Her mother, my grandmother, Cripes, my grandmother was born in the 1880s. But, you know, my grandmother taught my mother to say things like, clientele for clientele, you know.
Right.
My mother even said vacuum, pronouncing all the syllables.
Vacuum the clientele.
Yeah. Yes, we must go and vacuum the clientele. You have to draw a line somewhere here, okay?
Right,
you know, another
right.
one along those lines is there's a lot of de-anglicization going on in the language. One classic example, didn't make my top 10 list, but I should mention it, is F-O-R-T-E. How would you pronounce that?
Forte.
Sorry. You're doubly wrong.
Really? Really?
Yeah, yeah. This is a word that comes into English in the early 19th century from French, direct loan word, and somebody somewhere added the E. It really didn't start out that way. It was spelled initially just like F-O-R-T, the stronghold English
right.
word. And but from French, it meant the strongest part of the blade of a sword.
Okay.
So it was pronounced fort, and in English, fort. You pronounce the T, one syllable, fort. Now, the E got added, but it was still traditionally pronounced fort. See, somebody thought it was like a feminine French noun, so they added the E. And,
right.
you know, this happens.
Right.
English spelling is a mess. It's a complete mess. And if you ever look at the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, you'll see that nobody has ever known how to spell an English word. There are like 16,000 ways to spell every single English
right.
word.
So, so the proper use of that word would be, instead of saying, oh, that's not my forte, you'd say that's not my fort?
It's not my fort, right. And
really?
the first confusion that happened was it got confused with, once that E was, spurious E was added, it got confused with the Italian musical direction F-O-R-T-E, which means play loudly, right? So that's forte, accent on the four. So for a while, people pronounced both those words the same. It's my forte and play forte. you know, I can sort of go with that, but not really. But when they started to say, when people started to say, like you, forte, and put that accent on the second syllable, man, that's when I had to get my shotgun out.
It's a good thing we're just on the phone then, because I got a lot of them. I'm sure.
Because,
I've never,
you know, and I have
it.
Even
I've never
seen
heard it the other way.
Oh, no, no, don't tell me that. I have
I'm
even
serious.
Seen it in print. In print. Have you seen it in print with an accent over the E?
Yes, I have. Yeah, absolutely.
Horror.
And I never
this, okay. Oh, my gosh. Then this is the most horrifying thing that could ever be spoken on your show.
We are a horror show, so now we have that.
Yeah, I mean, forte with that pronunciation and an accent over the E is perhaps, okay, it really should have been in my top 10 list. That is perhaps one of the greatest abominations of English.
That's,
okay.
See, that's interesting, though. This is good stuff to know because, yeah, I mean, it's like I said, I've heard it that way. I've never questioned it. I've seen it written with the accent, never questioned it. I mean, yeah, never. Never thought a thing of it.
Well, open your...
Now I know.
Open your benighted eyes and look again.
My benighted eyes? I will, I promise.
Okay, so moving on to number six. Here we have Loath versus Loath. You know, Loath is just L-O-A-T-H, but it seems to have been abandoned in favor of the verb, Loath is an adjective, meaning disinclined, unwilling. But it seems to be being sort of abandoned for the verb loathe. Notice the difference in pronunciation. L-O-A-T-H-E. And people write and say, I am loathe to do that.
Right.
Well, loathe is a verb. It's only a verb meaning to hate or abhor.
Right, right.
You have to say you're loath to do something without the E.
I'm loath. Okay, yeah.
And so I am loath to allow loath to replace loath. Does that make sense?
Nice. Got it.
Okay.
That's a good one.
Number five.
Yep.
There's a problem in the language I've been keeping track of, various examples, where the sound alike that's, you know, with two sound alike words, similar sounding words, the one that's kind of more literate, fancier, what have you, that tends to get used in place of the more everyday hardworking word.
Right.
And because people get tired of using the everyday hardworking words and they say, I need a variation, so they kind of reach for something they don't really know. And here's this prominent example. Reticent used in place of reluctant. People will say, when they mean unwilling, disinclined, they will say reticent. That's what reluctant means. But they will say, I'm reticent to talk about that. Meaning I'm reluctant
to talk about that.
Yeah,
that one is bad. That one, I haven't heard that one. That doesn't sound right, though. I mean, just to my ear, that doesn't, I'm reticent to have that discussion. That doesn't sound right at all.
Good for you. Good for you. Good for you. Your ear is speaking to you well. And the thing to remember, the mnemonic here is if two follows reticent, it's wrong. Don't put two after reticent, because reticent means, by derivation, reluctant to speak.
I see.
Okay?
Yeah.
So
good.
So number four, another word that I have eschewed, and it's not eschewed, it's eschewed.
Ooh.
I have eschewed this. Yes, it is. It's
in
my big book of big mispronunciation. Okay, so it's eschewed, and I have eschewed the word unique for some 40 years. because nothing is unique anymore. It comes from the Latin unus, one soul only. You can't have something else that is unique along with something else that's unique. You can't have, you really properly can't modify unique by saying it's almost or somewhat or mostly or whatever unique. You know, there was an example in the American Heritage Dictionary some time ago where, which went something like this: Omaha's most unique restaurant is even now more unique.
That's a good point.
You can't be more unique. You're either unique or you're not. So, you know, I have proposed over the years lots of other synonyms: singular, peerless, matchless, so on
peerless.
And so forth. Yeah, so just don't use what. And again, what is wrong with the everyday word? What's wrong with unusual? You can say more unusual, somewhat unusual, almost unusual.
True.
But you know, but unique. Come on, just give it a break. Give it a chance to survive as a you know, it's been drowned in bad usage. Okay, number three. We're getting to the really serious stuff now. It's and its. I-T-S versus I-T apostrophe S, right?
Right.
So my colleague in language mavenry, Constance Hale, author of Sin and Syntax and other wonderful books on language, very dear colleague, Connie Hale says about its and its, learn this or die.
it's a tough one, but it really was one of the, not one of the easiest things that I learned, but when I was young, it didn't make a lot of sense to me, but once you get it and you see it, I agree. It's important.
There's a dude, I can't remember his name right now, but I was just reminded of this. There's some British dude who's got a funny website with photographs on it, where he's gone around taking pictures of what he calls apostrophe catastrophes. And so you have like the grocer's apostrophe, onions with an apostrophe before the S,
right?
That kind of thing.
Right.
Cucumbers apostrophe, three for a dollar, you know.
Right.
And he's got all these pictures of that, and I have to applaud his zeal, you know, because they're out there, waiting to kill you. The false apostrophes. Watch out on a dark night when you go around that corner. There may be an apostrophe waiting for you. a spurious apostrophe.
I love it. Yes.
So it's an it's. The simple mnemonic here is the one without the apostrophe is possessive. That means it belongs to whatever follows it. And the one with the apostrophe is a contraction for it is or it has, right? That's
right,
not so hard
right.
to remember, okay? Right. So number two on the ambulatory semi-literate zombie list, I and me. I may catch you here, Alistair. I'm not sure. But if you don't know the difference, you are a zombie, and we survivors will shoot you, okay? So there was a cartoon not too long ago in the New Yorker. I love these New Yorker cartoons that are about language. I keep them, and I frame them sometimes, put them up in my office.
Nice.
And this one showed two guys at a bar, and one of them says to the other, "You have no idea what it is like to be a just between you and me person in a just between you and I world."
Nice. That's kind of a tough one, though. I mean, it's that's a tricky one.
Well, everybody grows up who has half an education who's only half a zombie, whatever.
It's true.
you grow up getting admonished for saying, can Johnny and me go out and play?
Right.
And so you think that me is a bad word. And you don't really think about its role as a pronoun, an objective pronoun in a sentence. You just think, oh, me is a bad word, so I better say I. So people start
right.
saying, for you and I, between you and I, and so on and so forth. So you get a whole slew of half-educated people, semi-literate zombies, saying something they think is educated. But what we call this is a hypercorrection. You're bending
right.
over backward to be correct, but you're making a big mistake.
Right, right. And it sounds like it, too, oftentimes. Like you hear
well,
it
if you
like,
take
oh,
out the other part.
Okay.
Take out the other part. Take out the you or the, you know, between you and I. You never say this is, well, forget the between because that needs two people. But you would never say
right.
for I. You,
right.
You'd always say for me. But if
right,
you add, an,
right.
you know, if you add another person or 10 other people for John, Joe, Jerry, and Susan, and me, because it's for me.
Right.
See, that's the grammatical part that people haven't taken the time to figure out. In that position with a preposition before it, it's an objective pronoun is required. I is the nominative pronoun, meaning the subject of the sentence. I went to school. But the objective pronoun comes when you have the preposition before it and something is being, you know, done for it or to it or whatever. So to me and to her and for him or her or whatever. Yeah, so that's
right.
it is tricky. It is tricky, but doggone it. I'll do my Lewis Black again. What the hell is wrong with all you people?
I have one that's probably going to upset you, but I will bend over backwards to avoid this. And this is okay, so I'm talking about our book, for example. Say it's you know, my and Tamara's book, Tamara's and my book, mine and Tamara's. How does I don't even know. I'll be honest, I have no clue. So I just don't say it.
You know, that's a great question. I would prefer of those options. I would prefer Tamara and Tamara's apostrophe S and my book because you are a team. And when it's truly a team, you want to do it that way with the possessive pronoun and the apostrophe, and preferably with the possessive pronoun second and the apostrophe on the name first. If it's not so much, if it's not so clearly a pair, a couple, whatever, then you can leave off the possessive stuff. What would be an example of that? Shucks. Maybe Tamara and my. No, I don't know. I mean, here's where I have to go reconsult my, you know, Chicago manual style and my other guides. But I was a consultant for Brian Garner's Modern English Usage, and I find myself going right. back to it all the time to remind myself what's right or to confirm my guess or my supposition. So yeah, but
right,
I think
right.
the answer I gave you for that example, I think you can rely on that.
Yeah.
So we have
that makes the most sense, but it's just tough because it doesn't quite sound right. No matter how I say it to me, it just doesn't quite, you know, Tamara's in my novel, mine and Tamara's novel, my and Tamara and mine. It just doesn't sound right.
No, Tamara's and my novel. That would be good because it, you know, it's actually a lot like for you and me, not I.
Yeah.
You are coupling it with your possessive pronoun there. So that's good. And I guess what I was thinking of before, by way of example, was if it's also very much of a coupled notion, you could say, like if you guys owned a house together, you lived together, owned a house together, you could say Tamara and Alistair's house. So there'd be only one possessive there after the final element, Tamara and Alistair's house. But if you're using that pronoun, you need to put the possessive with the first name, Tamara's and my house.
Right. Right. I'm going to use this as much as possible as soon as we're done, because I'm going to make it stick. I'll be tweeting about this stuff.
Oh, good. Good. All right. Spread the word. You know, that's the thing about language. Yeah. I exercise my universe-given right to opine, and some would say be a blowhard, about language. Well, you have that right too, don't you?
I don't have any special right
to do that. I'm just exercising it more than you are. Go for it, buddy. You know?
That's right.
So we've got two more. We got two more.
All right.
No, we have one more. We have one more. The number one. Yeah, mistake made by ambulatory semi-literate zombies. It's a mispronunciation. But really, I should say there's a tie for first place, okay? There's a tie for first place. One's a mispronunciation, which I'm going to ask you if you can guess, the most mispronounced word in the English language. And the other is a distinction, which is in my book, How to Tell Fate from Destiny. Any idea what the mispronunciation is?
I wouldn't even dare to guess, but I'm pretty sure I probably am doing it.
Yeah, right. If you guessed, you'd mispronounce it, right? Okay, it's the word that's spelled N-U-C-L-E-A-R. There should be sound effects. You win.
Really?
Nuclear. Yeah, nuclear. The people, the zombies, who mispronounce this say nuclear.
Nuclear,
and
really?
Of course, they do not even hear themselves mispronouncing it. That's the problem. So it is nuclear, like new and clear, right? Nuclear.
Right.
And the mispronunciation is nuclear, which is called a metathesis, where things get mixed around, switched up in the middle of a word. You hear this
right.
In the mispronunciation of realtor for realtor or jewelry for jewelry, that kind of thing. So that's a big one. That's my number one mispronunciation.
When you said nuclear, it's funny because I'm like, of course it's nuclear. That's how I say it. And I never thought anybody mispronounced it. But then you said nuclear, and I'm like, no, yeah, you hear that all the time. You do. A nuclear.
Well, good
bomb.
For you, because you're one of the few who don't recognize the mispronunciation. Ain't that grand?
Yeah, right. Right.
You're going to heaven, or as I say in my book,
yay!
you might be in limbo or purgatory, and you don't know the difference, do you? You know. So
yay for me.
So the tie for that is also in How to Tell Fate from Destiny, and that's the difference between. And this is the worst grammatical error everybody in the world makes. Which I should probably give up on and say, as William Sapphire said, when enough of us are wrong, we're right. I don't always agree with that, but it's kind of true. But I just can't give up on this. I cannot give up on this one. It's part of my DNA. Lie versus lay. The verbs lie,
oh,
to lie, and to lay, okay? And
yeah,
everybody
this
gets
one, this
wrong.
We avoid two. We avoid this one. We just, well, both of us, we'll just be like, eh, there's got to be another way to say it. Because I admit it, first one to admit it, I can't keep them straight. I don't get it.
Well, you want the lesson?
I do.
Or are you
going
to die a semi-literate zombie?
I don't want to die a semi-literate zombie. I want the lesson. Okay. I would love the lesson.
I think I'm going to have to write a book called, you know, Lessons for Semi-Literate Zombies or something. And then my editor is going to say, you know, somebody's going to say, you didn't put a hyphen in semi-literate. I'm sorry, but there is no hyphen in semi-literate. You know? So. Okay, so Lion Light. Lion Light. This is what you need to remember, first off. To lie is to come to rest or recline. To lay is to put or place. So what we have here is not, as they said in that great movie with Paul Newman, Cool Hand Luke, a failure to communicate, or maybe we do have a failure to communicate. what we have here is the difference between an intransitive verb and a transitive, okay? So to lie, the verb to lie, is intransitive, which means that as a verb, it can just do its work without affecting anything else. You don't need anything else that it does its work to, okay? You can just lie down, right? You can just lie on a table, on your bed.
Right.
So, but the transitive verb, as all transitive verbs do, the transitive verb lay needs an object to do its laying on. So you have to lay the book on the table. You have to lay me down to sleep. You have to lay something somewhere. You have to put or place it. Right?
Okay. Right. This already makes more sense than anything I've ever been told before. And seriously, it's okay. So lay requires basically assistance. You do it. It has to be done to. Lie does it by itself.
Yeah, that's
correct?
The beginning. But
okay.
But we get into, this is where we get into trouble, because the past tense of lie, the intransitive verb, is the same as the present tense of lay. So you lie down on your bed today, but you lay down on your bed last night. And that's where people get the two confused, because, you know, you lay something on something. So they think, well, if I put myself on my bed to go to sleep, then I lay myself on my bed, you know, and that's where they get mostly confused. You know, I lay down on my bed, because you could say last night I lay on my bed, right? That's a problem right there with the same, you know, conjugations. And then finally, the past tense and past participle of lay, the transitive verb that means to put or place, gets confused for the past tense as well of lie. So people say the past tense of lie is lay. Like, I lay down last night because I was tired. But people, confusing it even further, people take the past tense of lay and they say, I laid down on my bed.
Right.
You know, which means, you know, if you laid down last night, you're a chicken. You're depositing fat, fresh eggs on your bed, right? You laid them there. You put them there. You placed them there. So, if that were not enough, thank you for the subjunctive tense. I'm keeping it alive. If that were not enough, the past participle of lie, the intransitive verb, is bizarrely poetic, and nobody uses it anymore. 3 days, you know, in the past, I have lain on my bed.
Lain.
Yeah. Nobody says that anymore, except for nerds like me.
You have to admit,
so
though,
it may be hopeless, but I'm telling you, I'm not giving up.
Right, but you have to admit, the lay, lie, lain, laid. You have to admit, even you have to admit, this is absurd. You know, this is just crazy.
English is absurd. English is absurd. If you don't think your language is insane, then go speak another language, you know, and join that caravan of angry white men and go to Canada. Yeah, it's just
right,
I mean,
right. I can handle just about any of it. It's like, oh, okay, I get that. Oh, that makes sense. All right, not a big deal. But when it comes
right.
to lie, lay, laid, lane, and I'm glad that was your number one, because if it wasn't, I would have said, please make that your number one. Because when it comes to that, I'm just like, you know what, I give up. It's just whatever.
Don't give up.
Sat down.
This is if this is my only message to the world, if this is all, you know, I don't know how many words I've published, too many, millions. But if I had just a tombstone, you know, an epitaph to leave to the world regarding language, it would be don't give up. Just stick to your guns, you know?
Just keep trying.
keep track of it. Keep trying. Stick to your guns. Don't believe these cherished superstitions, as I mentioned before, about things like prepositions at the ends of sentences. Get informed. Read my books. Read all the you know, informational popular reference guides or dictionaries, whatever, you know, usage guides, whatever, that you can get your hands on, and make up your own mind. Be informed. Don't just let it happen to you. You know, Noah Webster, the father of American lexicography, once said in his Dissertations of 1789 something along these lines, that he used to model his pronunciation after the last person with whom he spoke, whose opinions and character were deserving of respect. And then he acknowledged that was really stupid, because what? You know, maybe this person is a molecular biologist, but what does he
right?
or she know about pronunciation? You know, or how to use words properly. I can't tell you how many educated people I've documented who screwed things up, you know? So,
oh, sure, sure. You can't be good at it all. Now, your latest book, How to Tell Fate from Destiny and Other Skillful Word Distinctions, came out in October, so it's brand new. And this is just one in many that you have that I'm hearing all kinds of just fantastic things about. This is how we came across you. Tamara came across, I believe it was How to Tell Fate from Destiny, and just loved it and said, you know, oh, we got to get this guy on. This is just fantastic stuff. And so before I let you go, tell us a little bit about How to Tell Fate from Destiny and where people can find it, what they'll find in it, and also tell us where they can find more about you online, et cetera, et cetera.
You bet. So, How to Tell Fate from Destiny and Other Skillful Word Distinctions is for any distinctioneer. I invented that word for this purpose. Any enterprising and ambitious distinctioneer who wants to get things right, who cares about the nuances of the language. And we're talking about a book that is partly a thesaurus and partly a usage manual, and it will tell you how to distinguish, say, between, you know, in its spindrift pages, as I like to say, alluding to the poem by Dylan Thomas, in its spindrift pages, you will discover whether you are pitiful or pitiable, whether you whether you're contagious or infectious, whether you're going to wind up in limbo or purgatory, whether you're eating Welsh rabbit or Welsh rarebit, and of course, how to tell whether you're living an ethical life in a moral universe. These are distinctions that a lot of us take for granted and often mess up and confound. So I wanted to sort those out, and that's really what this book is about. It also has lots of just regular thesaurus-like synonym discriminations as well. It's good for writers. It's good for anybody who cares about precision in language.
Right, right.
And you can buy it, as I like to say, of course, from the Goliaths out there, the Amazons, and, you know, that's easy. But
right.
If you have your favorite bookseller, please go for that. It's always good to keep those folks alive. And if you want more information, or if you want more to know more about me and my work, you can go to my website, please, at charlesharringtonelster.com. Altogether, Charles Harrington Elster, ELSTER.com.
All right, fantastic. It has been a pleasure. I'm really glad that we did this, and you know, I hope that you'll come back, because Tamara is totally bummed, and I think we could do, considering how interesting this stuff is, we could do this. We got a lot more of this in us, I think. So hopefully.
Well,
I've
written well over a million words about these things, so. Trust me, I have plenty more to say.
All right.
And I appreciate
that.
You know
what? I'm gonna hold you to it. We'll be in touch. Thank you for being on. Thank you everybody for listening. Until next week, we wish you haunted nights, sweet screams, and of course proper use of language. Thank you for listening.
Haunted Nights, live with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross.